Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So the technology sector of our economy has been one of the most important parts of the country for decades now. Young people coming out of college, Sam and I see them all the time, are eager to get into this business. Computer coding is often seen as a real gateway to innovation and to economic security. The role of the coder has even been cemented in popular culture with shows like Silicon Valley that focus on the lives of these young people. But like all parts of the economy, the actual workforce often continues to be defined by racial, gendered, and economic structures that sometimes are in full view and other times are more hidden from our sight. Breaking through these barriers will be essential if we are to make these sources of economic innovation the most that they can be. Today we have with us Kimberly Bryant, who is the founder and executive director of Black Girls Code, a nonprofit organization dedicated to introducing young girls of color to the field of technology and computer programming with a concentration on entrepreneurial concepts. The organization focuses on girls who are aged between 7 and 17 to teach them about computer technology by creating websites, writing computer applications, working on robotics, and much more. Bryant has spent more than 20 years in the pharmaceutical and biotech industries with many different companies. She also serves on the National Champions Board for the National Girls Collaborative Project and the National Board of the NCWITK 12 Alliance. She was honored in 2013 by the White House for her work in tech inclusion and her focus on bridging the digital divide for girls and much, much more. So it's a real honor to have you on our show. Welcome to Politics and Polls.
Thank you so much for having me.
So maybe we could just begin by having you tell us a little bit more about how the organization came to be.
So Black Girls Code is a nonprofit organization that was founded in 2011 in the San Francisco Bay Area. My motivation really for founding Black Girls Code was that I really found that my daughter, who was going into middle school at the time, had really started to have this strong interest in computer science, primarily through computer gaming. She was a very heavy gamer, still is. And at that time, back in 2010, 2011, there were not very many female or girl gamer communities where she could tap into and find this tribe, if you will, of other girls who were into gaming and coding as she was at that time. When I started to explore opportunities for her to do out-of-school time activities to kind of build on this interest that she had developed, I did not find many that catered to young girls, and very few, even in the Bay Area, that had students of color heavily engaged. And that started as this pathway of creating Black Girls Code as an opportunity to create an organization that would foster the interest of girls like my daughter Kai, and really start to change this narrative that we were seeing in the tech industry with the lack of diversity and very few women and girls that were elevated in the computer science industry or technology industry. So it started from that, you know, very, I would say, motherly interest in making sure my daughter had an easier pathway, with myself having a background in engineering as well.
And you were working in the private sector when you made the decision to focus full time on this?
Yes, I was working in the biotech industry in the Bay Area as an engineering manager, and really found that although I had graduated decades, literally, before my daughter even started to express this interest in computer science, that the field had really decreased in the number of women that were engaged or getting bachelor's degrees significantly from when I got my degree back in the mid-'80s.
And when you went about to set the organization up, what did that entail in terms of finding people to work with you and financial resources?
Well, luckily, when we started back in 2010, we were right at the tip of this learn to code momentum that was happening, not just in the Bay Area, but everywhere. But it was primarily focused on adults, getting adults to code and adults learning to code on Codecademy and tools such as that. But at that moment in 2010 and 2011, where this started to shift, like the conversation started to shift around how it was important for young people, kids, to start to learn to code as well. So we sort of rode that wave as a grassroots organization in the Bay Area. Our very first partner that was a financial fiscal partner for us that gave us a grant funding for our work was Google. And then we found other partners, both in the Women in Tech networks in the Bay Area and beyond, that came in to help us train these young women about the technologies that they would be encountering ongoing in the industry and beyond.
Now, your goals seem to be pretty ambitious. I was looking at Black Girls Code website. Looks like you've got chapters around the country now. And what are your targets for how many girls to reach and which girls to reach?
Well, we have a big, what we call hairy, audacious goal to train 1 million girls to code by 2040. Right now, we've reached about 9,000 or so students across the U.S., and then we also have a chapter in Johannesburg, South Africa. We really try to build our chapters in areas where we can reach this demographic of African-American, Latina, Native American girls in a very intense way. So each chapter will reach anywhere from 500 to 1,000 students over the course of a year. But that will grow as we expand to new cities in the U.S. and also look at areas where we can grow the organization abroad.
You seem to have a pretty significant presence in the Raleigh-Durham area, which strikes me as a good community because it's growing tech sector, significant African-American community, and inequality yet proximity, so that if only the right bridging people were there, it feels like one could jump a gap there.
Absolutely. I think when you look at our most active chapters, surprisingly, some of them are ones that you would may not expect to be heavy tech sectors, but maybe you would. So DC is probably one of our most active chapters, and that's a lot of government technology. I think when you look at it, we don't think of DC. We think of it as a policy town, but it's heavy in tech sector from a governmental perspective. Another heavy hub for BGC is also Atlanta. Growing tech industry in Atlanta, also a very hearty African-American presence on the business side, which is makes it one of the most active chapters for us. And then the two coasts. So New York is one of our largest chapters, as well as the Bay Area. So when you see outliers like Raleigh-Durham, which seem to be one of the most expected places for behaving in tech, you'd be surprised that some of these outliers actually bubble up to the top.
So I want to get into the topic of what the barriers are for girls and girls of color getting into coding. If I think about you touched on the story of your daughter being interested in gaming. I'm a father of an 11-year-old girl myself, and I'm trying to understand, is the barrier interest, or is the barrier they get there and then it's kids who don't really look like them and they don't feel like they belong? What are the leaks in the pipeline when a girl either has an interest or might have an interest in these things?
I don't think we can downplay the issue of community when it comes to women in tech. It's crucial that when you enter a space where you're exploring your passion, there are other folks that have similar backgrounds, experiences, and perspectives as you do. I think one of the barriers for women in the industry over the last several decades has been that we have been absent in many of the positions of authority and leadership in the tech industries that are kind of ruling the roost, so to speak, currently. And that has really discouraged many young women to pursuing computer science as a career path. That's slowly but surely starting to change now with the work of organizations like Black Girls Code, but also as Women in Tech, Women Who Code, other women-based and technical organizations that are really starting to share this narrative as women as tech leaders. But it's difficult if girls don't see a representation of themselves in place.
Now, you and I seem to have learned to code around the same time, and I know, I say that because you and I have as our first languages Fortran and Pascal. Pascal's a real tell.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's like Pascal. Yeah, man. It's like not C. Right.
No. I actually started when we had to compile languages. So I started writ Fortran as my very first language.
Yes, yes. So I felt a certain kinship when I saw, oh, yeah, Fortran, right line commands. But anyway, but I was thinking back when I read that line of your story about that feeling of learning how to code and that feeling of getting a thing to work. Mm-hmm. And my experience was that it was satisfying, and I was also socially awkward, and so but I made friends with people in my class because I was pretty good at it, and so I ended up connecting with them. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a racial advantage in the sense that people look at me and think I must be able to code. There's actually been some funny stories about like some Asian guy who was a humanist and he couldn't code at all, but people assumed that he could, which is kind of, I can't even grasp that. But I'm just trying to. I want to hear a little bit about what it's like to be, I don't know, good at it, and then yet, do you make friends that way? Like when you were a beginner, like did that help make friends, or were people surprised? Mm. You know what I'm asking about? The experience of being a beginner.
Well, for me, it's interesting. Although I graduated at the end of the 80s when there were about 35% or so women that were receiving these bachelor's degrees in CS, it did not feel that way for me as a college student. I did not have very many women. I can't really remember if there were any women in my computer science classes.
This is at Vanderbilt?
Yeah, I remember vividly spending nights in the computer lab. Well, maybe everybody does that, but I spend nights in the computer lab alone, like working on these programs.
Okay, that part's not different.
Okay. But I really don't remember that many women being in my computer science classes, certainly not in my electrical engineering classes, but it was an isolating experience. And I see that reflected at times in my daughter Kai's experience, even before she got to college and was in her AP classes in high school. And I remember vividly she had a big major project to do at the end of her AP class, and she's ambitious, so she decided to code this project in a language that she hadn't used before. I think she was using Swift or something. It's for the first time, and self-teaching herself, as coders do. And she was struggling a bit with it, and I asked, like, well, what about your other teammates? And she was like, well, yeah, I'm working on this by myself. And I was like, what do you mean? And she literally said that all the boys in the class paired up together, and my daughter is actually a naturally good coder. She was alone, and they left her out, and the professor didn't even put that two and two together that he had one student that just happened to be a girl, just happened to be a young woman of color, working on this project by herself while everyone else in the classroom was paired up. And that happens a lot. So it's not about that you're good if you're a woman and the others in the class are just going to naturally navigate towards you. It doesn't happen that way, unfortunately. And so many times if women are in a situation where they're the only in these technical environments, they don't get the privilege, I think, of just being smart and being able to track others to their team nature of that.
So in child development, and also anybody who's been a parent knows that people like to play with, you know, kids their own sex, who kind of look like them. And so it just strikes me that's a difficulty. I mean, again, speaking as a young nerd, I'm channeling that. I think if there was some girl in my coding class at that age, I think I'd be afraid to say, let's work on this together. It would be a social thing. And so so it just strikes me that there are these barriers. And I don't remember that particular barrier when I was a kid. And I'm really kind of lingering on that because that just strikes me. Like, for instance, my daughter doesn't want to be part of a coding group at school because it's a bunch of boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not what who she wants to hang out with.
Right.
And it drives me crazy because she's got tech smarts.
Mm-hmm. I get it. I mean, I've went through that same, you know, scenario countless times with my daughter. I think as she started to develop self-confidence in being in those spaces by merit of the other things that she was doing outside of those classrooms to gain her and develop her technology skills, that improved. So by the time she ended up being a high school senior, she ended up being co-captain of a robotics team, and it was all boys except for two girls. And And she naturally fit into that environment, was able to navigate it. But I think as a beginner, and when you're coming into an unfamiliar space, it's a bit harder to make that leap initially. And that's, I think, the issue that we find with many girls.
So what have you been finding? So you have this organization that is dealing with these cultural issues, structural issues that inhibit or have inhibited participation. And here you are creating all kinds of spaces and incentives to get into this area. What have you been finding in terms of how it might have an impact back at the school? You're focused on girls 7 to 17, mm-hmm. so they're still in school. What's the effect been that you've been seeing in different parts of the country?
One of the things that we found with our students, especially the students that have been in the program for quite some time, several years, so to speak, is that not only are they gaining technical skills by way of the opportunities and workshops that they are participating in with Black Girls Code, we're seeing this also parallel effect on their leadership ability, their self-confidence, that's reflected in the things that they do back at school. So that may mean that they're being more active as campus leaders in various organizations. They may be starting coding initiatives on their own. They may be starting science projects or side projects on their own. So it's been interesting that although we did not build for this, that leadership development into the curriculum or the theory of change as we built the organization, that's been one of the side effects that we've seen the students gain by way of participating. And I believe, you know, indefinitely that's because they gain a certain level of self-confidence, a self-efficacy by way of really gaining these technical skills and being able to share their ideas that translates into other areas of their lives.
And the people working with the girls are all volunteers? Is that most of your...
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, primarily.
And who are they?
They are like computer scientists. They are literally working computer scientists, data scientists that may be working at a Facebook, a Google, a Twitter. They may be at a Lyft. All the technical companies that are actually doing work and want to see, interestingly enough, they want to see a more diverse workforce of colleagues, and they build it by way of giving by their volunteer time.
And the participants, do they pay for their admit tuition, or is this all funded?
Most of it's funded. So about 90% of the work that we do is funded, but we do offer a small stipend for a workshop on a Saturday. It's about $35 per student. For a two-week summer camp, it's a little under $200 per student. And then the rest of the cost for running those workshops and those events is subsidized by corporate partners, so like Microsoft and HP, et cetera, that actually Oracle, that give us funding and sponsorship throughout the year that help us to drive the work that we do.
And do you interact with teachers at all in the schools where these kids are going back to in terms of thinking through, what might be best or strategically how to improve your outcomes?
Well, from the standpoint of our interaction with teachers at the schools, they are primarily the ones who reach out when they have a student that is interested in coding. Mm-hmm. And they want to open up an opportunity for them to either find a community, or they want them to be able to explore their computer science and learning these computer science skills in a bit more depth. So a lot of our recruitment efforts actually happen via teachers reaching out to us directly, or us in terms of the organization creating partnerships with the schools that then funnel the core of students that actually end up participating in our workshops to us.
What are you finding about resources in schools? It strikes me that that public schools especially have shrinking budgets, and I'm thinking about this in a few different ways, both middle class schools that are somewhat hurting for resources, and then schools that really have budget troubles, like schools in more distressed neighborhoods that are of lower income. What do you have any thoughts or advice about what you've seen and how one would make coding better where it fits in?
Yeah, one of the things that's been interesting to see is over, I would say, the last 6 years, there's certainly been more introductory CS courses, a more of a focus on AP CS as a course of study. in most major metropolitan areas. Now, that doesn't mean that all of these offerings will be consistent across in any given metro area. So there may not be all of the schools in Oakland, California will have these offerings, but a heavy number of them will, so that we find that students that come into our after-school programs at least have some introductory knowledge of computer science, which is great because this was not the case in 2010. I think as we've kind of been talking about today in my other meetings is that the problem lies in is that there's either one introductory class perhaps in middle school and then AP computer science and then nothing in between, which doesn't necessarily lead to building capacity of the students once they get college ready. Right. So whereas we have some intro computer classes and then we have AP, we need gates in between. And we probably also need to back into elementary school as well. So by the time students get through middle school and high school, they have a greater familiarity as well as self-confidence with their skills as technologists. And I think that's one way we can move the needle further in terms of increasing and broadening participation in the field.
What about clubs? You say that there's one class and then nothing. Can these kids do it with clubs? Like, would that be a thing that...
I absolutely think they can do it with clubs. One of the models that we're piloting within Black Girls Code is a code club model where we would take an elongated after-school program offering into a school system for 6 weeks, 12 weeks, even a semester long, and work with a small group of 30 or so students over an extended period of time. That's a way to piggyback on what they're already learning in the classroom and then allow them to go deeper and create some projects based on their learnings that we can actually support.
What's the biggest challenge that you faced as an organization in terms of thinking of the next few years, where you want to go and what you want to address that hasn't worked out as well as you hope? What are some areas where you kind of see room for improvement or are frustrated with something that you've encountered?
The biggest challenge that we've consistently faced as an organization is that we have a greater demand than we have resources to fill. So you would think over the last 5 years with the predominance of so many kids coding organizations coming into play that there would be enough computer science for all to go around. There's not. Like, we consistently get 2, 3, 4 emails on a daily basis with, you know, can you bring your program to here, to Columbus, Ohio? Can you bring your program to Kansas City, Kansas? And it's difficult to say no because we understand there's such a great need right now for these programs for our kids. That is why, you know, I certainly believe in making sure we have computer science in every single middle, elementary, and high school is important for this generation of learners. And I also think it's important that we increase funding to nonprofit organizations, NGOs that is doing this work in after school time, because there's been research that shows the importance of programs that enhance students' capacity outside of the classroom. So I think there's a funding issue that we fight against in terms of growth and scale, as well as making sure that there's at least the basic access for every student that we can't reach.
I have to interject at this moment that Princeton University has made some pretty significant efforts on diversity in the undergraduate student body. Really in the last 5 years or so, it's been really striking to me as a professor who's been here for a while. So I'm just going to put in a plug that there might be human talent. I know you've been visiting here the last day or so.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that some students have shown up on your doorstep as you've been making visits, because I think that we've got some students who might be pretty committed to this kind of thing.
I've talked to lots of students, and one of the things that I've been most impressed with is the students that have come to visit me and their, I would say, their pairing of these issues in technology with social issues and social policy and their inquiry around how the two intersect. I think that is one thing in the industry, this whole conversation around policy and ethics in technology is something that I'm certainly interested in this next generation of learners and academic students exploring and how it impacts us as new technology comes into play.
Well, a significant change in computer science, at least from when I and evidently you were a kid, is getting away from coding and the activity of pure coding where you just like getting an algorithm to work. And as you're saying, connection to social roles, social change. Mm-hmm. It feels like bringing diversity into the ranks of coders and people at all level of technology feels like it would be attractive to the girls who are getting interested in this. So have you found particular topics as good for drawing those girls in?
Well, any social change and social justice issue that the girls have a particular interest in is a hook. So we do many projects where girls are building applications, not just for the sake of building, if you will, but for the sake of solving a problem that just may need technology as a lever. I shared with the students this week a few of the projects our students have made around safety, around mentoring, around bullying, all of these social issues that you would expect a teenager or a young adult to encounter in their daily lives. The girls address those by utilizing the technology tools that they've gained through the program. And the applications that they create are an outgrowth of that. And so that when I think of one of the things that really attract girls to participate in our program on an ongoing basis, is that community as well as that ability to use tech for good that always keeps them coming back.
Wait, we can have an app to address bullying?
Yeah. They've built it before several times.
I'm liking that. I mean, one thing it reminds me of, it's sort of at a very different level, but as these girls become women who become leaders in the field, this is a different topic, but things like machine learning research that shows that natural language processing, if you just scrape the entire contents of the web and build algorithms that use that pooled knowledge of all humanity, it has racial and gender biases in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now what do we do, right? And that's like, and if you just built the algorithm without thought to that, then you'd build a thing that reflected the biases of all its inputs.
Mm-hmm.
And so is there some girl out there, maybe your daughter, maybe somebody else, who's going to deal with that?
I hope so. One of the things that I think, you know, is important to us is to make sure we introduce our girls to where technology is going. So when you think about machine learning, artificial intelligence, there is certainly an opportunity for bias to be built into the algorithm. I think the way to navigate that is to have as many technologists of diverse perspectives sitting at the table when these algorithms are built and to test the algorithms as possible. Unfortunately, the field of AI is growing at such an exponential pace. My concern is that we will struggle to keep up, you know, and that makes to make sure that we have a diversity of perspective as we start to really see AI take control is one of probably the key concerns that I have right now. And it's why we started to really work with organizations like Black in AI back in 2018 to start building some preliminary curriculum to get into the hands of our students.
I just have to say, as we're winding down here, I wanted to mention something that you're doing in May. It hasn't come up yet, but you're going to an event that's super interesting for anybody in the Nashville area. You're going to the NCWIT Summit on Women and IT. And I have to say, as impressed as I am with you in person, I'm seeing that there's all kinds of people at this thing. Do you know these people already? Mayim Bialik, and then, of course, there's I'm just looking down this list. Is there a community of people who see each other at these things? I'm going down here. There's another one. Catherine Johnson, the famous, now she's retired,
yes.
The engineer.
Mathematician, yeah. There's certainly, one of the benefits of organizations like NCWIT is that it does bring together such a strong community of both educators, folks in the industry side, folks on the nonprofit side that are doing this work around technology and diversity and inclusion. And we can share not only our work, but also the research findings and explore areas of common interest.
And you're all going to be there in May in Nashville. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
Could I just ask one last question about your own career and trajectory, which is really fascinating how you moved from private sector job to creating this organization that potentially is already having massive effects and has really emerged national spotlight as doing something fundamentally important on issues of race and gender and the economy. What advice do you have for people not only seeking to get into coding and technology, but who are thinking of how to actively change and address basic problems that we face in terms of what you have experienced as a leader of this organization?
I think that's a fantastic question. I often mention in my travels that I had absolutely no plans to become a social entrepreneur when I stumbled onto this problem, and it hit home. Like for me, it was sitting in my home. It was living in my home. It was, you know, this pathway that my daughter was going to potentially experience in her future path. And I took a leap. I mean, that's it. I mean, I did not know how to run a nonprofit organization. I am a technologist. I am a nerd by training. And I took a leap because there was a problem that needed to be solved. And I activated my own self-confidence to take a step out and be the one to solve it, as opposed to sitting back and let it take its course on its own. And I think anyone can do that, and it may not necessarily need to be in a big way. I didn't necessarily think this would become a national movement, if you will. I just wanted to solve a problem and make the world a little bit better for my daughter. And I think we've done so much more than that in the process.
Well, it's an incredible story and organization, and there's many people I talk to who are fortunate to be able to speak with who've had roles such as yours or achieved this kind of change, and their story is often just what you said. It's a moment of problem solving that changes your life and then obviously changes the lives of everyone who you help. So once again, our guest was Kimberly Bryant, the founder and executive director of Black Girls Code. You can learn more about the organization at www.blackgirlscode.com. And Sam and I definitely urge you to take a look and do what you can. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I should interject that as we're recording this, this coming Saturday, April 6th, there's a Black Girls Code event in New York City, which you can read about at blackgirlscode.com.
Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Listeners, if you have questions for either of us, you can email them to us at politicspolls@princeton.edu. You can also just tweet them at us. I'm at Julian Zelizer. Sam?
I am at Sam Wang, PhD. That's not how I pronounce my last name, but that's how you can spell it right. Samwang, PhD, and that's on Twitter.
Well, thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.